Depending upon which jurisdiction you consult, today is either Columbus Day or Indigenous Peoples Day. It commemorates the arrival of Christopher Columbus in 1492 on an island in the Caribbean, a small event that triggered an avalanche of colonization in the Americas, resulting in the deaths of many of the indigenous people of the continents. University of Oregon professor Jeffrey Ostler takes up the story of the new Americans pushing out the Native Americans in the United States in a book called Surviving Genocide: Native Nations and the United States from the American Revolution to Bleeding Kansas. If you listen carefully to that subtitle, you realize this book only goes up to the time of the Civil War. A second volume is in the works. Jeffrey Ostler, as I mentioned, professor of history at the University of Oregon, the author of three previous books about the pre-colonial inhabitants of North America and the people who displaced them. Dr. Ostler, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Let's talk about the title first, Surviving Genocide. A generation ago, people didn't say genocide. What brought about the change?
Well, when I was doing my research, one of the things I came across was a number of statements by Native people, really some in, as early as the 17th century, but around the time of the American Revolution and after, statements by Native people that essentially said, what we think is happening with these colonists and then, you know, these Americans is that they intend not only to take our lands, but to kill us all in order to get those lands. And so I think there was a real sense among Indian people as they were living through the history that I write about that what they really faced was the literal possibility of genocide, that, you know, they're next generation might not exist, and that's really what they were up against. So that was the inspiration for my title, which was that, you know, the challenge they faced historically was literally that, to survive genocide.
And to have their story told.
And to have their story told. And one of the things I tried to do in the book, I tried to document all of the ways in which United States actions and policies were damaging, very destructive to Native people, I think in many cases to the genocidal proportions, but also to try to show how Native people survived. And I think that that's a really critical point to be made, that, you know, many of your listeners will know this, but some may not. You know, that Native people have survived and still exist. They have sovereignty. We have over 500 federally recognized tribes, other tribal communities, and of course, right, you know, in your area of Southern Oregon, there are many, many such communities. And, you know, there's Native students at Southern Oregon and so on. So that's an important part of the story, too.
The opening vignette in the book brings together Alexis de Tocqueville, Choctaw people, and their dogs, and it packs a wallop. What did de Tocqueville see, or what report that he saw?
Well, you know, while Alexis de Tocqueville had come to the United States, mainly he was interested in the U.S. prison system, of all things, but he became broadly interested as he traveled around in democracy, and he wrote this famous book, Democracy in America. And a little-known passage in there, he happened to be at Memphis, Tennessee in 1831, and he witnessed the Choctaw Nation being forcibly removed out of Mississippi across the river into Oklahoma. And he did indeed write quite movingly about that, about how, you know, the Choctaws were very stoic, he said. The river was cold and icy. They were suffering. And as they departed the shores of the Mississippi for the other side, their dogs swam in after them, howling to their death as a kind of omen of, you know, Choctaw disappearance. So it's a very powerful passage. An interesting thing is that it didn't really happen that way. Tocqueville wrote his mother at the time, before he wrote Democracy in America, in a letter, said to her that, you know, the Choctaws grabbed a hold of their dogs and put them on the boat because they needed them, you know. So Tocqueville was romanticizing just a little bit there, but he did capture something very powerful, I think, in that passage.
Indeed, the idea of people moving off to an unknown fate. As you point out, Jeffrey, there are thousands of books on this subject. What did you want to do differently with Surviving Genocide?
Well, to some extent, my book is a synthesis, that is to say, taking a lot of scholarship and piecing it together and kind of getting a broader picture. Last 30, 40 years especially, we've had a great renaissance of writing about American Indians that, and a lot of the scholarship has been produced by Native scholars and writers. But we didn't have, a kind of comprehensive overview of the impact of United States expansion on the Native people of what became the United, under what became the United States. And so I thought it would make a contribution to try to put together a lot of what we know and provide a more general overview. So that's the kind of starting point of the book and its main purpose.
There's one major concept that it helps us to understand up front, and you point out a difference between settler colonialism and ordinary colonialism. What is the difference?
I grew up thinking of colonialism as sort of, well, the British Empire. And if you think of in most places in the British Empire, like India or Africa, the point of colonizing those places was largely to extract resources. And it wasn't so much to eliminate the native people of those areas, but rather to exploit their labor. But what we've now come to understand is that there are a number of situations in modern history where colonists go to a certain place, and the idea is not that they're going to exploit the labor of indigenous people, but they want to settle permanently, and so what they want is the land. And that's settler colonialism as opposed to ordinary colonialism. And then the idea is that indigenous people, need to be removed in some way or another. They need to be killed, or they need to be expelled, or they need to be assimilated.
So in ordinary colonialism, you want to take resources out and employ the local population, sometimes through slave labor. In settler colonialism, you want to put people in addition to taking resources out. So that's the difference here. Something had to change then for Native Americans. Now, you part ways, you report in the introduction of the book, with other historians on how serious people in this country were about the idea of quote-unquote civilizing the indigenous population. Jeffrey, are you there?
Yeah. There's a lot of American leaders who talk about civilizing Indians as a humane way of uplifting them and then, of course, gaining their land. But as I was working on the book, I decided that a greater priority, and if you looked at actually what American leaders were doing, is that they were preparing the way to remove Indians living in the East across the Mississippi and to relocate them to what becomes places like Oklahoma and Kansas. And the key figure is really Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson liked to talk about civilization, but if you look at what he was actually doing, he was conducting treaties to try to eliminate native lands, and he was also negotiating treaties with Indians west of the Mississippi River to reduce their lands so that, he could then make those lands available for the removed nations from the East.
So now here's a bit of a surprise. You think indigenous population went up in five decades before 1830?
Right. This was a real surprise to me. It was a question that I had as I was working on the book early on. I wanted to know if we take the area east of the Mississippi River in, say, 1776, how many Indians were there in that area? If you look at the same area in 1830, which is when the Indian Removal Act is passed, how many Indians were in the east then? I posited that the number would be lower, that there would be fewer Indians in 1830, but it's not true, actually. There's probably about 20% more in the east, which is counterintuitive, but an interesting finding.
Well, and as you point out, 1830 is a dividing line. That was the year that Congress passed the Indian Removal Act. And this is a part of your point that the indigenous people faced an escalating imbalance of power. But you say it was not a complete imbalance.
No. And, you know, there's times when U.S. actions against Indians are very intense. There's times of relaxation. There's times when Indian people have more space and leverage, you might say. About the Indian Removal Act, one of the important things here is that the major justification for the Indian Removal Act of 1830 was that Indians in the eastern United States were vanishing, that their populations were declining, that they couldn't live among white people. It was a racist argument, and we know that. One of the things, though, that we don't know is it's just also empirically false. Indians weren't, their populations weren't declining. And it's one of the ways in which, you know, the policy, frankly, is built on a lie at its most basic level.
Well, and there are other things that figured into the lowering of Native population over time. And you take an excursion into the idea of virgin soil, the belief that Natives died from direct exposure to diseases they had not previously been exposed to. You find that a bit more complicated. How?
Yeah, I'm drawing on a lot of scholars now who are challenging what has been known as the virgin soil epidemic thesis that was put forward in the 1970s, the idea that most of the population decline in the Americas was because of brand new diseases hitting people at the instant of European contact, smallpox and measles, and wiping out 70-80% of the population. That's the big story. And, you know, it turns out that there are some cases of this in North America, but the larger story, I think, and the much more common story is that epidemics and poor health is related to colonialism. It's related to European actions that create conditions that promote disease, favor its spread, and also make it very difficult for people to recover from disease. You know, if you get hit once, but not again, your populations can rebound. But if you keep getting hit over and over by multiple diseases simply because you're poor, you're malnourished, and your healthcare systems are being destroyed, it's extremely hard to have population rebound. And that's more the story in North America than this virgin soil epidemic story that we've had for a long time.
So pre-1776 in eastern North America, was there any one region that had marked drop in population than another, where the extirpation was more pronounced?
Probably not. You see the severe population collapses in New England. You see similar kinds of episodes in the South and in the Ohio Valley. It's not uniform. There's some tribes, the Shawnees, for example, who are, you know, relatively small people, located mainly in the Ohio Valley, but they migrated a great deal. As far as I can tell, their population was fairly stable, indigenous nations in the Great Lakes area, Ojibways and Ottawas, as far as I can tell, also had fairly stable populations from, say, the 17th century when they were first contacted by Europeans into the early to even mid-19th century. So there is quite a bit of variation in what happens.
Let's talk about some specific events here, because you bring up the case of the Paxton Boys in Pennsylvania in 1763. What happened there?
Well, the Paxton Boys were a group of, I guess you might call them, a kind of vigilante militia, and were essentially ideological Indian haters. This event occurred during a very widespread uprising or revolt by Indians in the Ohio Valley and into the Great Lakes, known often as Pontiac's Rebellion or Pontiac's War, and they were revolting against some of the things that the British Empire was doing in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War. The Paxton Boys, a militia in western Pennsylvania, in settlements had been attacked by Pontiac's people, and they wanted to stop that and take revenge for that, but they couldn't actually get to the supporters of Pontiac's rebellion, and so what they did is that they turned against a peaceful group of people, of Indians who hadn't been involved in Pontiac's rebellion. These were Conestoga Indians living in sort of central Pennsylvania, and, you know, just simply attack them with absolutely no reason for it. So it's, I think, a clear-cut case of a genocidal massacre.
The book is called Surviving Genocide, Native Nations and the United States from the American Revolution to Bleeding Kansas. It's the work of Jeffrey Osler, a professor of history at the University of Oregon. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a phone call from Bill in Eugene. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Exchange. And Bill is listening to us on the radio, so he can't hear the fact that we're 10 seconds ahead of him. So we'll try to come back to him. So we talked about the Paxton Boys. That incident took place in 1763, and there was a proclamation of 1763, which did what?
Well, in response, really, to the Pontiac Rebellion or War, the British Empire decided that it needed to provide some kind of check on settler incursion on Indian lands west of the Appalachians. So they drew a line roughly at the crest of the Appalachians to block settlement. Indians were very well aware of that line, and they actually saw the British decision to create that line as a result of their own political and military action. And they also regarded the line as permanent. So according to their perspective, that line would still be there, you know, in 2019. Obviously it isn't. And the British, I think, regarded it as, you know, George Washington himself regarded it as a temporary expedient to quiet the minds of the Indians. I think he was right on that, and that's what the British intended, that they weren't going to completely stop settlement, but they wanted to regulate it and reduce conflict.
So what kind of feelings did the colonists' war against the British, the War of Independence, create among Native Americans?
Well, when the war broke out between the colonists and the British, Native people, I think, were very fearful of what would happen. Number one, they were fearful of being caught up in a war between two powerful groups being pulled apart. They had been caught up in a war between the French and the British during the 1750s and early 1760s. That had been disastrous for them in various ways. Here, it's coming again. Second, I think they were afraid the colonists would win. Many Indians supported the colonists. Most tried to stay neutral, and many supported the British, more supported the British than the Americans. And the reason really was because they feared that the colonists would be more aggressive than the British toward them, more likely to take their land, more likely to exterminate them all. You know, they could cite, for example, the Paxton Boys as evidence. You know, they had a story to tell when they evaluated these situations. You know, there's nothing particularly mystical about it. It's all very empirical. They were good historians, and they had eyes and ears.
So there's another key event to ask about in the same general period of history, the Gnadenhut Massacre. Tell the story of that.
Yeah, this is, I think, a similar event to the Paxton Boys. And it's roughly 20 years later, 1782, at the end of the American Revolution. And again, it's Pennsylvania militia. And again, what they're trying to do is to attack or take revenge on Native communities that are sponsoring raids on settlements. I mean, this is happening. Native people do regard settlements as illegitimate, and they will raid them and try to, force those settlers to return east. So those raids are occurring. So what the Pennsylvania militia does is it wants to get attack the raiders, but it can't. And so it turns on yet again another group of peaceful Indians. This was a group of about 100 Indians known as the Moravian Indians, because they had been converted to Christianity by Moravian Christians. And so they really tricked them into surrendering what few weapons they had. They put them in two separate guardhouses, men in one, women and children in the other. And they apparently had a vote as to whether to kill them all. The militia did, and apparently they voted to do that in a sort of perverse example of democracy. They voted to have genocide and then proceeded to kill every single person, man, woman, and child.
That was in 1782, after the surrender of the British at Yorktown. So not quite Treaty of Paris, a few years before the Constitution. Was there consistent thought among the founders of the Republic about what to do with Native Americans?
Well, I think that U.S. policy has a kind of structure of options as it develops. And one of the things I've tried to do is clarify this, that policy isn't just what leaders say they would like to happen, but it's also involves policies for what would happen if option one doesn't work. And so I think option one is to have Indians voluntarily give up their land through treaties. That doesn't happen. Indians don't want to give up their land. The United States then turns to option two, which is to use a variety of coercive and, frankly, deceitful methods to try to create the illusion of voluntary consent. And that partially works, but it doesn't totally work, because then what happens is that a number of Native leaders realize that these treaties have been negotiated through underhanded methods and regard them as illegitimate. And that means that those leaders then claim a right to self-defense and believe that they're right in taking up arms or potentially taking up arms against an illegitimate invasion of their lands. Then when that happens, United States officials turn to the next option, which is to wage war against those leaders who are resisting. And that war is genocidal war. The U.S. does have a policy to destroy towns and villages of resisting Indians, and that means killing not just fighters, armed men, but it means killing all the inhabitants, men, women, children, and so on.
Was there any particular segment of the public, the European American public, that thought this was horrible, that you shouldn't be killing women and children, for example?
Well, it depended on the circumstances. So in the case of both the Paxton Boys and the Gnadenhutten Massacre, there was, particularly among East Coast elites, a kind of sense of being appalled by this, and certainly critical of the uncouth frontiersmen who had done it. But that sense of being appalled doesn't last very long, actually. There was going to be a congressional investigation of Gnadenhutten. There really wasn't one. Ben Franklin had denounced the Paxton Boys quite strongly, but he was less severe against the perpetrators at Gnadenhutten. One gets the sense that by 1782, elites in the East who see themselves as humanitarian toward Indians are, have been affected by the violence of the war and are less sympathetic even to something like the killing of unarmed, less appalled even by massacre. And certainly frontiersmen are perfectly willing to engage in massacre when they can. There's very little sense of this being immoral.
Jeffrey, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, same year as the Constitution, had a huge bearing on land claims as the country grew up. What did it do?
Well, the Northwest Ordinance created a template for settlers to create territories and then states. The Northwest Ordinance is often celebrated because it's really, you know, brings in all the new states on an equal footing. Most historians don't think too much about its impact on Indians, but it obviously, the most basic level, is a law that assumes that Indians will be gone from those areas that will be created states. And I also think that it outlines a policy for waging what is called in the Northwest Ordinance just and lawful war against Indians. What I think that means is genocidal warfare under conditions in which Indians resist what the United States declares as reasonable terms for giving up their lands. Of course, Indians don't think those terms are reasonable when they resist. The United States says, well, now we're going to go to war with them. It will be just and lawful. I think those wars are, in fact, genocidal.
And you're actually quoting from the clause. It does say just and lawful war, right?
Yeah. But, you know, what does that actually mean in practice? Frankly, historians haven't really looked at that. They've just kind of assumed that, you know, statements like our wars are going to be just and lawful are true somehow. You know, that we're going to show utmost good faith to the Indians. That's another phrase from that same ordinance section, and that, you know, that we'll just take for granted whatever U.S. policymakers say. I think we need to dig deeper.
Were there any places east of the Mississippi by the early 19th century that were relatively safe for Native Americans?
Yeah, depending on the time and place. Certainly there's, you know, there's a period after 1795, I would say, into the War of 1812, so the lead up to that. So there's a 15-year period where there's relatively little violence. There's not much militia activity. One has the impression of occasional murders, not to trivialize that, but compared to what had happened and what will happen in other places, you know, it's a period of relative peaceful coexistence. Indians don't have as much land as they used to, but they're building different kinds of economies. They're making accommodations to the outside capitalist settler world, and it's under those conditions that their populations are going up. It's a time where there aren't major epidemics. So, you know, it's interesting, and then what then happens after seems all the more tragic because, you know, there had been a period of relative prosperity.
So the let's skip ahead then and get to the Indian Removal Act of 1830. Was it precipitated by anything, or did it have a large issue with who was in the White House at the time?
Well, it's often associated, of course, with Andrew Jackson, who had come into the White House in 1829, and he was a big advocate of Indian removal. But I think it's a mistake to pin it on Jackson. I think it would have happened anyway. I think that it was being planned since 1803, at least, when the United States acquired Louisiana from France. That was the area that, you know, people were going to be moved to. Jefferson, when he acquired Louisiana in 1803, said it's going to be of great value to us for Indian removal. I think the thing is that the United States didn't have the capacity to do it. The institutional, it was impractical. But by the time you get to the mid-1820s, you can start talking about it in serious ways, and you can start planning for it. And when Jackson comes onto the scene, he's going to push hard for it. But I think the critical thing is the United States now has the infrastructure to be able to pull it off, to be able to force that many people out of their homelands and expel them in into new areas.
How extended was the debate in Congress about the Removal Act of 1830? Was it long and ferocious, or was everybody pretty much in agreement?
It was long and ferocious. And in fact, the Indian Removal Act passed very narrowly in the House of Representatives. And the only reason it passed was because of the disproportionate influence of southern states. It's really the southern states who were mostly behind it. The disproportionate impact of them because of the Three-Fifths Clause, related to slavery.
You mean they wanted to get the Native Americans out?
Yeah, they were in favor of removal. And northern states wanted removal, but because they were political enemies of Jackson, they were Whigs, Jackson was a Democrat, they didn't like the way Jackson was doing it. It's not that they opposed removal. When the Indian Removal Act passed, Northerners moved just as hard as Southerners to get rid of the Indians in their states, in their areas. It was about the means that Jackson was using to try to force tribes, particularly the Cherokees, west.
So if you had Southerners proposing to, or working a bit harder than Northerners, perhaps, to get Native Americans out of the region, you had some crossover that you point out in the book, too. You had occasionally Native Americans supervising African-American slaves?
Oh, yeah. So the Southern nations, particularly the Cherokees, Creeks, Choctaws, and Chickasaws, and to a lesser extent, Seminoles, had developed institutions of slavery some years earlier, really starting in the late 18th century. They had enslaved people, people.
So how much was the federal government's policy in any way about divide and conquer? Either going tribe by tribe or even person by person, or was it all just about all you leave?
Well, always the United States wants to create the impression that what it's doing is honorable. And one of the critical things then is to make it seem like Indians are agreeing to everything. And so the removals were all accomplished through treaties. They got people to sign treaties saying, we agree to go, and there was payment involved and so on. In order to get those treaties signed, and they were usually signed by a minority of people, and they were signed under enormous pressure, the United States uses divide and conquer tactics to do that. They'll bribe people. They'll ply them with alcohol and things like that. And then they'll present a treaty that was actually agreed to only by a minority of leaders under duress. They'll, present it as though it's a consensual majority decision when it's not.
Were there any offers of if you move into a house or in a farm, you can stay or anything like that?
Yeah, some of the treaties have some of that, particularly the treaty with the Creeks and some of the northern nations, Potawatomis, have provisions. They were particularly for leaders, and sometimes they function, I think, as bribes, that we will give you and your family a big chunk of land, and you can stay here. You're not going to be a tribal member. You'll be subject to the laws of the United States and the state of Alabama or whatever it is, but you can stay. The rest of your people might have to move, but you and a few others can stay. So there are provisions in there for things like that, yeah.
You mentioned that by 1830, the United States had the infrastructure to be able to pull off something like a mass movement of people. But once removal was the official policy, was there a detailed plan, or was it a bit more ad hoc than that?
It was pretty ad hoc. You know, they didn't, they kind of had to invent the process they were going along. How do you supply people? What role is tribal leadership going to play in the process? You're going to have to set up camps along the way. You're going to have to decide whether to do the journey beginning in the spring or in the fall. Is it worse to travel through such and such a place in the summer when everybody might get sick from what they saw as fever in those days, really malaria? Or should you go in the winter? Everybody might freeze to death, you know, particularly if you don't have enough supplies. So it was pretty ad hoc. They could do it. They had a big enough army. They had roads. And, you know, there were enough settler positions along the way to pull it off. But it also took a long time. The removals took, 15 to 20 years, really, before they were complete. That's partly because there was a lot of resistance to the process.
Well, and speaking of resistance, you point out, and I'm skipping back in time here now to 1776 or thereabouts, but that the Native Nations did band together and form alliances to try to fight resistance. And
yeah,
obviously, ultimately, those did not work, but did they at least forestall things or get them any better terms?
Yeah, it's a very important part of the history. There are huge, really two major phases of intertribal pan-Indian political organization for the purposes of resistance. On their own terms, I guess they do fail. I mean, the idea of them is to block U.S. expansion, and of course that doesn't happen. One might think of movements like this, though, as succeeding in the long term in the sense of being able to inspire later activists. And so even now, I know Native scholars who are involved in the movement at Standing Rock a couple of years ago against the Dakota Access Pipeline, who took inspiration in these kinds of movements, of resistance. So one could see continuities over time in the way these movements continue to inspire people.
So Jeffrey, we get to the point where there's a major question here, and to do the things that happen, to commit genocide, human beings have to get to a place where they think of other people as not full human beings. In all the accounts that you have reviewed to get to this book, is that a line easily crossed?
Well, I'm honestly surprised by how easy it seemed to be for Americans to cross that line, and how easy it was for American officials, presidents, secretaries of war, military leaders to call for the extermination of Indians. All the presidents used that rhetoric. They weren't, it wasn't just talk. They were prepared to send armies to do exactly that, to try to surprise villages of citizens and kill them all. And soldiers did it. And there doesn't appear to be much resistance to that, much moral outrage. There's moral outrage on the part of some people when peaceful Indians are killed, but when resisting Indians are killed, it seems to be a completely consensual act with very little dissent, and soldiers themselves seem quite willing and able to do it.
And a real buy-in for that revenge from the public, as we have seen. When might we expect the next volume in the series?
Oh, I hope I can finish it. I'm getting on in years, so the next 5 years would be nice. It'll be a while.
All right. We hope to have you back for that. This is called Surviving Genocide, Native Nations and the United States, from the American Revolution to Bleeding Kansas, the work of Jeffrey Ostler, historian at the University of Oregon. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.